Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago, this year, Leonard Bernstein took the helm of the New York Philharmonic. It was 1958. The city, the country, the conductor were bursting with energy. As composer and conductor and public figure, from West Side Story and Broadway to Carnegie Hall, Leonard Bernstein embodied that energy. This year, New York is looking back. This hour, On Point. Leonard Bernstein, New York, and the American Century. You can join the conversation. Do you remember how he glowed, how New York and the country glowed when Bernstein took the podium? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Barbara Hawes. She is archivist and historian for the New York Philharmonic. Her new book, co-authored with Bernstein's brother, Burton Bernstein, is called Leonard Bernstein, an American Original. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
With us from Los Angeles, with an essay in that book, is Tim Page, former music critic for The Washington Post and now visiting professor of musicology at the University of Southern California. Tim, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, shark or jet, I'm not sure, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Hello, Tom, Barbara, and Tim.
1958 is kind of the hinge moment for the 50-year anniversary that New York is paying attention to this year, the time when Bernstein became the first American-born music director of any major symphony in the country. But it wasn't by any means his first appearance there. Let's listen just for a minute. Leonard Bernstein, with his professional conducting debut almost by accident, the New York Philharmonic's regular conductor, Bruno Walter, fell ill right before a Sunday broadcast, November 14th, 1943. The young Bernstein was waiting in the wings, and he took the podium for his national radio debut.
Good afternoon. United States Rubber Company again invites you to Carnegie Hall to hear a concert of the New York Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra, of which Artur Rudzinski is musical director. Bruno Walter, who was to have conducted this afternoon, is ill, and his place will be taken by the young American-born assistant conductor of the Philharmonic Symphony, Leonard Bernstein.
And with that, a new era began to be ushered in at the New York Philharmonic. Barbara Hawes, introduce us to the young man then, 1943, who would later become the director in 1958. Who was the Leonard Bernstein who stepped to that podium on that day?
Well, he was only 25 years old. He had just been appointed an assistant conductor to the Philharmonic by the music director, Artur Rudzinski, in August of that year, and this is November. So he'd been really just sitting in the audience and at the rehearsals for all the performances at Carnegie Hall. And there he was, contacted on the Saturday night before, saying that Bruno Walter, who was to be the guest conductor, was ill. A great snowstorm was in, and Artur Rudzinski couldn't make it in, and so he was expected, without a rehearsal, to go up and lead the Philharmonic. Which was, what was really interesting about this, is if it had been on a Thursday night, he wouldn't have been broadcast live over national radio. And this is what really put him on the map there, is it was a national telecast, one of the weekly of the Philharmonic.
Tim Page, he would come to almost stand for, embody, I'm not sure what the right word is, but all the energy, cultural energy, or so much of it, of the time when New York was the colossus on the world stage, you know, economically,
yeah, that's
culturally.
True. He had been living actually upstairs above Carnegie Hall, so he was actually ideally suited for that debut concert. By the 50s, it was very interesting because not only was he an American, which I think startled a lot of the more conservative members of the audience.
The first American-born music director, as we noted, of an American major symphony, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But he was also, then as now, there was some suspicion of anything that wasn't quote-unquote highbrow classical music, and he happened to have the biggest hit running on Broadway at that moment. So it was really a startling and brave choice by the Philharmonic, and it paid off spectacularly.
Jack Beattie, when you think back on Leonard Bernstein, the images that he and his music, I mean, right across the boardwalk. But the images, the Broadway, the images they bring to mind, the time, the piece, the chunk of the American century, and it's a big one, that his face brings to mind for you and his music.
Well, there's a book about the 50s and 60s called The American High, that moment when anything seemed possible, when family incomes were racing ahead of inflation, when people were, wasn't the chicken in the pot, it was the motorboat in the driveway. And when something exciting was going on in the arts, there was a breaking down of the barriers between high and popular culture, and a bringing into high culture of the vulgar vitality of pop culture. And on the other hand, an influence of high culture on pop culture. And right at the center of that was Leonard Bernstein as a person who almost embodied it, the flamboyant, highbrow, yet also Broadway showman, TV personality, musical genius, an American original. I guess that's the title of the book.
Yeah, no kidding. We heard some of his Candide, the 1956 operetta, behind the opening here. Let's listen to just a little bit of Bernstein's Second Symphony, Age of Anxiety, 1949. Here, the man who would bring West Side Story to the country brought something quite different. It's based on W.H. Auden's poem, The Age of Anxiety, 1947, about four New Yorkers having a night on the town. This part takes place when the four are dancing together in an apartment and having a nightcap. This recording features Bernstein himself at piano. Tim Page, Leonard Bernstein would take Americans to Mahler and Shostakovich, but right there I hear something closer to his Broadway face. What do you hear in this passage, Tim, about the Leonard Bernstein who took New York and the country by storm?
Well, it's good jazz. It's good sort of crossover jazz. I mean, that is a dirty word in some circles, but the fact of the matter is it sometimes can work, and I think it does work here. I mean, you've got some boogie-woogie. You've also got remarkably astringent harmonies for the classical world at that point, and certainly for jazz listeners. It was music that kind of stretched you in all kinds of different directions. And Bernstein would continue to try to do that with varying success, it must be said. Somebody once said that Bernstein could do anything he wanted in the world so long as he didn't put his mind to it. He was so utterly brilliant at just putting together something like the Young People's Concert or tossing off a masterpiece such as the Candide Overture, which I think ranks with the best overtures of Rossini. But it's funny because he often tried to do perhaps a little bit too much, and some of the charm went away. It's a little bit like those Woody Allen films where he all of a sudden decides he's going to make a serious film, and it sort of seems that he's given up his sense of humor. Bernstein occasionally went, I think, too far in the I am a great thinker direction. I think Ned Roram said that, in fact, he was a brilliant, inspired doer who didn't have to prove to anybody how smart he was.
He was famous in part later for talks he delivered at Harvard explaining the nature of music. They became famous. Virgil Thomas said of them, "Nobody anywhere presents this material so warmly, so sincerely, so skillfully as musical mind openers. They are first class as pedagogy. They are matchless." Here's Bernstein interpreting Beethoven with his own hands on the piano in his own words.
Are we feeling what Beethoven supposedly felt when he wrote these notes? Now, I know what I'm feeling. I'm feeling, please, please, I implore you. I'll do anything if... And comes the reply, yes, but only on certain conditions. Please, I said, pretty please. If you don't, the other hand, if you do...
Leonard Bernstein, from one of his Harvard lectures, 1974. And Barbara Hawes, New York, just all over Bernstein this fall. I mean, performances on every corner, it seems, from what we're reading here.
Well, I think the collaboration between the Philharmonic and Carnegie is just a terrific thing for the city. We brought in Lincoln Center Great Performers, as well as the Paley Center on Media, Jewish Museum. You're right. It seems to be everywhere. And it's touching on all of the aspects of his life, from his film work to his composing to his own religious faith as it's reflected through his music, and as well as then just his compositions. So it's a great time here to be able to reevaluate, to look at, and to really re-listen to a lot of what Leonard Bernstein was able to achieve.
We are going to come back and do that. Think about New York in those years, America in those years, kind of the heart of the American century. We're talking this hour about Leonard Bernstein, the great composer, conductor, showman. Here's a bit from On the Town, written in 1944, New York, New York here. The musical he composed, action takes place over 24 hours. Three sailors look for love during a layover in New York City. That and so many more Bernstein pieces that just grabbed the country and the world by the throat. You can join us, 800-423-8255. What do you remember? How do you remember of Leonard Bernstein? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
How was your day in New York?
Oh, wonderful. I don't remember a thing.
Awful. I remember everything.
Manhattan women are dressed in silk and satin, or so the fellas say. There's just one thing that's important in Manhattan. When you have just one day, gotta pick up a date.
Maybe seven
or eight on your way in just one day.
New York,
hell of a town.
The Bronx is up and the battery's down.
The people ride in a hole in the ground.
New York.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Leonard Bernstein and the American century, 50 years after the great conductor, composer, and showman took over the New York Philharmonic. Of course, right there, West Side Story, Dance at the Gym, 1957. You can join the conversation. How do you remember this magnetic maestro? How did Leonard Bernstein shape your view of the world of New York, of music, of possibility? And what's the story Bernstein told of America, of New York City, that wonderful town? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Barbara Hawes joins us. She's archivist and historian for the New York Philharmonic, co-author of Leonard Bernstein, an American Original. Tim Page joins us from Los Angeles, former music critic for the New York Post, now visiting professor of musicology, very grand, at the University of Southern California. Our own Jack Beatty is here. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Dana's on the line from Brewster, Massachusetts. Dana, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you. And to your guests as well. Well, you sort of stole my thunder when you alluded to the Norton lectures at Harvard, which I believe were in 1973. I was watching a video of them in our town library, and I had majored in music, and I was sort of dejected and burned out. And
yeah.
Thinking, why did I bother? And I watched these lectures, and especially lectures 4 through 6, from the, you know, where he connects Mahler in the Ninth Symphony. He made me, by the way, really appreciate Mahler in a way I couldn't before.
You and many others. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And then he drew a line in the 20th century, and what a badly written book it was, the 20th century. Mm. And Mahler was the prophet, and he said it was consumed in the Beatles, such as their later, like, The Day in the Life, She's Leaving Home.
Mm-hmm.
The way he drew that line, the use of metaphors in music, it really inspired me again, and I started practicing again. And, you know, this has all happened in the late 90s, so, I mean, Bernstein to me is just a venerable New York and American institution, and it, you know, and he brought it all to Harvard.
And brought it all to you, and brought you back from being a burned out musician to back in the game. It's a wonderful personal story. Tim Page, what about that spanning? I mean, there's the spanning again. Never mind West Side Story and Shostakovich. There's Mahler and the Beatles and one musician inspired by Bernstein. What was it about him constitutionally or his perspective on the world or his energies that led him to span so, including classical to pop so often?
Well, he had such extraordinary charisma, and he just seemed a walking personification of the art of music. I remember talking to a musician in an orchestra who, you know, played under all sorts of grand maestros, and his favorite was Bernstein. He said, because whenever Bernstein comes here, I remember why I wanted to become a musician. We talked a little bit about his music and a little bit about his conducting, and the gentleman we just heard from brings up his teaching, and in my mind, that may be his greatest single contribution. It seems to me inarguable that he was the most influential music teacher of all time, especially for those of us who are in our 40s or 50s and even into the 60s, thanks to Omnibus and the Young People's Concert and then later on the Norton Lectures. He had this ability to take very, very complicated ideas and make them absolutely simple. I keep hoping that somebody's going to reissue this film he did in about 1967 about rock, where he really goes into it, and he had very, very good taste. He's not just talking to the teeny boppers. He's talking to Brian Wilson. He's discovering the 13 or 14-year-old Janis Ian. Mm. I mean, you know, just amazing ears, an amazing sense that he wasn't going to fear any music. Indeed, he was going to try to find out what was going on in it, and he managed to express it to generations. And, you know, they're all available, or not all of them, but a lot of them are available on DVD now, and, you know, they teach another generation. They're really timeless.
Maybe there's nothing America would fear, though there was this was the time of the McCarthy and all that. There was plenty of fear at the same time. Jack, I hear you there.
Well, you know, apropos this point about being a great educator, this is a true story. A friend of mine told me she called her niece. This was sometime in the 1960s in California. And she said, I understand you can recite Peter and the Wolf. Mm. And the girl, 5 years old, said, yes, I can. And she said, OK, start. And the girl went, my name is Leonard Bernstein.
Now, the miracle of television and a charismatic
there
teacher.
It was.
Yeah. Let's go to Sue in Mendon, Vermont. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just enjoying Tom's conversation about him, Leonard Bernstein, being such a great educator. Because I was born in the 50s, and I remember coming home from a Saturday class I had, and this was when I was a very small child, and my mother sitting me down in front of the television and said, Young People's Concert is on, watch. And, of course, I pretended like I didn't want to,
yes.
But, of course, I did. And the thing that really impressed me was all these people in tuxedos playing symphonies, all of a sudden it was my music, my time. I was learning to understand it. And I think he brought classical music into my life as a child as something I could enjoy. And then when he connected with the pop music of the day, well, that just sent me over the top. It really broke the class structure of music as far as I was concerned.
That's
he was
one
a brilliant teacher.
Yeah.
He was my first music appreciation teacher.
We love that view, and you and many others. I want to hear one more right here, Sue, if we may. And thanks for your call from Mendon. Mike in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much for having my call.
Yes.
50 years ago, I would have been 7, and when the Young People's Concerts came on, I was a young child. I grew up in a blue-collar mill town in the Midwest where the concept of hearing orchestral music was just impossible, nothing on the radio, nothing within, you know, 60 miles. So that was my introduction to classical music besides piano lessons. And it was wonderful. I ranked the Young People's Concerts with the Bell Telephone Science Hour as sort of the things that from TV in those days that I remember. And I just feel that it not only was just wonderful, but the concept today that a national broadcast that would be watched by blue-collar people and wealthy people and classical music fans and rock and roll fans all sitting in the living room watching together today is just impossible. I mean, I had three black and white channels and I could watch on a Sunday afternoon the New York Philharmonic. Now I have 1,000 channels and I can't find anything anywhere near as good on TV.
Mike, you make a wonderful point. It makes us want to go back and listen, and I've got some tape from that. But I love that image of everybody sitting down and Leonard Bernstein speaking in that moment in this country, the heart of the American century, to everybody. Here's a little bit. And this is what, part of what both you and Sue were talking about. From 58 to 71, network TV channel, network CBS, would periodically turn its airwaves over to Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic for their young people's concerts. Here's one from 1961 before a Carnegie Hall, picture it, full of children. Bernstein explains that classical music comes from folk music, which comes from the way a people speak.
Yeyen hazak edişan yam Yeyen hazak edişan yam.
Why do we know immediately that that's a Hungarian tune? It's because the Hungarian language has a strange thing about it. Almost all the words in it are accented on the first syllable. Yeyen hazak edişan yam. That's how you can always tell a Hungarian speaking English, because he always says, I don't understand because I am Hungarian. And that same accent naturally pops up in the music.
And we love it because it sounds so cool. Let's get a call from Bridgewater. Oh, not just any call. From Bridgewater, Connecticut, Burton Bernstein, I believe. Leonard Bernstein's brother? Hello, sir.
Hello.
Yes, is this Burton Bernstein?
I believe it is.
Wonderful. Co-author with Barbara of the new book. And
that's correct. And I don't want to intrude on her moment with you. But
well, no, we're so glad to have you. You are the younger brother of Leonard Bernstein.
Much younger, yeah.
Yeah.
And the writer.
Yes.
Any case, what I want to do is correct something Mr. Page said.
He can take it. What have you got?
I'm sorry. I was listening to the radio at the same time. I just wanted to correct something Mr. Page said about my brother's debut at the Philharmonic on November 13th, 1943.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he already was established as a composer on Broadway and on the town, and that's not at all true. He was totally unknown at the time. His the biggest accomplishment of his life was having a performance by Jenny Terrell at Town Hall the night before the famous debut. And that's how I, as an 11-year-old, happened to be attending it, and with my parents.
I'm awfully sorry, Mr. Bernstein. I meant when he was actually appointed music director in 1958.
No, you said, I believe you said, he was during his debut with Bruno Walter.
But point taken, either way, may we ask you
He was totally unknown and became very famous overnight.
What did that mean for your family, Burton Bernstein? Do you recall your parents, your brother, the sort of the conversation at home when his rocket took off?
Yes, well, that's well vetted in the book, actually. I wrote quite a bit about that and in another book called Family Matters. It completely changed our lives, literally overnight. It was really like a movie, a bad movie, where you become instantly celebrities, everybody. So we were inundated by the press, especially in Boston, where we all came from.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were suddenly famous. But our next-door neighbors looked on us in awe. And, of course, nobody was more affected by this than Lenny himself, who had a rather difficult time with the press. He was very unused to talking to the press and got himself into a few problems there.
Barbara Hawes, you worked with Burton Bernstein on the book, and looking back on all this, what's your sense of how the family took it, the experience of going from relative obscurity, as Burton says,
well, slowly we got used to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were very, very ordinary middle-class Boston people. My father was a businessman in Boston, mm-hmm. and my mother was just a housewife. And they
but Burton, you were never ordinary. I don't believe you were ever ordinary, Burton. Burton and I went to the New York Philharmonic last night, and we listened to the Tchaikovsky Fourth.
Yeah, I'm hungover, by the way.
Yeah, right. Me too, Burton. I understand. And Burton turned to me in the last movement of the Tchaikovsky Fourth and said that he remembered Adolph Green had composed lyrics for the entire Fourth movement, if you can imagine that. And so even sitting in the middle of a Tchaikovsky Fourth, Burton has marvelous stories to tell you about his life, which it was remarkable. It was remarkable, all the people he knew.
Let's listen for just a moment to, this is 1959, when Bernstein took the New York Philharmonic to Moscow and performed, here's the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony, second movement, performed in front of the composer himself, Shostakovich. The concert was broadcast in the United States while the two superpowers were, of course, very much locked in the Cold War. Barbara, you and Burton Bernstein and others write about Leonard Bernstein's politics, the difficulty he had even getting a passport because of FBI scrutiny of his politics and perceived communist leanings. What did it mean for him to go to Moscow?
Well, at this time, we only learn later, of course. I don't think they actually knew at the time. He's under investigation by the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover has collected a file on him about supposed anti-American connections. And here the State Department anoints him, along with the New York Philharmonic, to be the representative of the United States to the Soviet Union at a time where those of us who were in elementary school were, you know, doing duck and cover under our school desks because, you know, we knew that the Russians wanted us dead. And here's Bernstein, and this is really what I think is at his core, is he believes so much in the power of music to change lives, the power of music to bring people together and to explain how really we are all the same. And he uses this message then to the Russian people speaking from the stage, and he brings it back in this television program then to the United States. And I think it must have been a remarkable, enlightening experience in 1959 to watch this audience of Russians who are just engaged with this marvelous conductor they've seen.
And Jack Beatty, those politics in a way on display as well in On the Waterfront, 1954 film famous with the Marlon Brando and Eva Marie Saint, Academy Award winning, nominated, score by Leonard Bernstein. We'll hear some of it in a moment, but this was loaded with themes of the time, Jack.
It was, and it was Elia Kazan's film, and in it, the man who rats, the squealer, the longshoreman who tells about the corrupt union is depicted as a hero, just when people on the left were depicting Kazan as a villain for naming names before HUAC and other committees. So this is a film that sort of, you can almost say it's anti-communist, or it's anti-communist rather than anti-communist, and it comes down on the side of the rebel who even squeals because it's the right thing to do. And in the score, what he does here is he invests a piece of pop culture with tragic, big resonance, the kind of high culture resonance we think of.
Burton Bernstein, we're so happy to have you calling in from Bridgewater, Connecticut today. Thank you very much for joining us, sir. Maybe gone already. We're talking about Leonard Bernstein and the American Century, 50 years after the great conductor, composer, and showman took over the New York Philharmonic. Barbara Hawes is with us from New York, Tim Page from Los Angeles, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. How do you look back on that era now when America and Bernstein were bursting with confidence, energy, can-do creativity? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Here's On the Waterfront.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Leonard Bernstein and the American century, 50 years after the great conductor and composer and showman took over the New York Philharmonic. Lots of celebration of that anniversary this fall in New York, and I mean a lot. You can join the conversation whether you grew up in the 1960s or the 1990s. Were you singing West Side Story, Sharks and Jets, Tonight, Tonight, Maria, Maria? What about the Mahler behind us right here? Do you remember that day 2 days after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy when Leonard Bernstein conducted a nationally televised concert of Mahler's Second Symphony? How do you look back on his era now? How do you remember Leonard Bernstein and his time? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. New York Philharmonic archivist and historian Barbara Hawes is with us. She's co-author with Burton Bernstein of Leonard Bernstein, an American original. Tim Page from the University of Southern California, visiting professor of musicology there now, joins us from Los Angeles, and our own Jack Beatty. Tim Page, Leonard Bernstein had a famous love of Mahler, and right here helped introduce America to Mahler at a very, very difficult time for the country.
And it's such a wonderful movement. Just listening to this in the background, it's just one of the most beautiful things Mahler ever came up with, the second movement of the Resurrection Symphony. Mahler, definitely, Bernstein had tremendous affinity for Mahler, and he conducted it in a way that was really brand new. There had been Mahler conductors before. Bruno Walter was a terrific Mahler conductor, and Dimitri Mitropoulos, who was one of Bernstein's mentors. But it was, I think it was a combination of the person and the place and the time. I mean, Mahler just spoke to so many people so much in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, still does, but he seemed to have a special relevance then when an old world was kind of dying and a new world was beginning to come in. And with all the introversion and with all the chaos and with all the, you know, glimpses of beauty, but through a strange new modern prism, and Bernstein, who, as I say, you know, just seemed to be an embodiment of this music, it was an extraordinary time. And I think most of us who were alive then really got our first real passion for Mahler through Bernstein's recordings.
I want to turn right now in New York to Clive Gillison, executive and artistic director of Carnegie Hall, and a cellist, former managing director for the London Symphony Orchestra, who played for Leonard Bernstein. Mr. Gillison, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, thank you very much for having me.
Remind us how and when you played under Bernstein's direction?
Well, towards the end of my time, when I was a cellist in the London Symphony Orchestra, I joined in 1970, and Lenny was involved as a conductor quite a lot in those early days, and in fact, funnily enough, listening to Mahler 2 now, that was one of the pieces that we did with him at that time. Hmm. But then I got to know him much better later on, because I became the managing director in 84, and in fact, from 86 until his death in 90, he was president of the orchestra, and we did a lot of things with him, including creating the Pacific Music Festival in Sapporo in Japan.
You know, Terry Teachout in the Wall Street Journal this week calls him the slapdash genius, acknowledges the genius, and who couldn't, and yet at the same time, you know, and there was kind of reference to this earlier, but that there was something like making it up as you go along, and you know, he doesn't always get the full serious respect that perhaps he thought he deserved. What was it like to play under him in that aura?
Oh, it was utterly compelling. I mean, it was certainly, you know, these were among the greatest experiences of my life. Sorry. And in fact, I remember we did once a Sibelius Fifth Symphony in the Edinburgh Festival, and I had to drive back overnight because I had to be back in London first thing in the morning, and it's a 400-mile drive. And I remember I was totally unaware of that 400 miles. The next thing I realized was I was in London 400 miles away with that music just whirling around in my head. I mean, Lenny was utterly compelling. And you mentioning that comment about slapdash, I feel it's the other way around. Mm. It's actually, he was always experimenting. He was always trying things new. You felt that this was the composer rediscovering the music every time he conducted a piece. That's why there was never repetition. He never did things the same. It was a journey of exploration for him throughout his life.
Now Barbara Haas,
I agree.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to say I agree totally with Clive. He wasn't slapdash. And what really, the evidence to support that is when you look at his conducting scores. Everything is worked out. Yes, he had this ability to seem as though he was simply emoting at the moment on the stage, but it was all carefully worked out. Everything was marked. Everything was thought through from every tempi to every phrase. And of course, in rehearsals, that's why his musicians had such confidence of playing with him, because he was so precise and so exact.
Yeah, I agree.
Tim Page seconding that, putting the slapdash in the back seat.
Yeah, no, I never really saw him as slapdash at all. I think sometimes he did things so naturally and so easily that he sometimes tried to complicate them with extraneous intellectual programs, which didn't necessarily always work.
Let's go to Justin in Vernon, Connecticut. Justin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just, I've just about finished Alex Ross's book, The Rest is Noise.
Yes, we talked with him. Wonderful book.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
We spoke with him. Wonderful book, yes, about 20th century music, yes.
Yeah, and he talked about Bernstein's affinity, Bob Mahler, and how he even tried to maybe be like him in trying to be a conductor as well as a composer at the same time, and he says that perhaps he burned himself out and might have thus had to neglect composition, having taken on such a big role. And the other point I wanted to make up was about talking about his American style and also how he brought out some of the lesser-known compositions of Charles Ives to the American public in, I think, around the 50s and showcased another true American composer.
Justin, let us pick those up. Barbara, first to you, on the two hats and more than two hats that he wore, but conductor and composer, and whether one cost the other.
Oh, I think that's very difficult to say. I mean, you know, we're all conjecturing on that. There are just only so many hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And being music director of the New York Philharmonic is an extremely demanding role. But he also brought a new kind of creativity to that role, and just his idea of how to program his music was extremely expressive, and I think got his ideas across. Whether it impacted his composing is hard to say. There's a story about Aaron Copland, who started to conduct more and more as he got older. And a friend said to him, "But Aaron, you know, I think the conducting's getting in your way." And Aaron simply replied, "Ah, but you've never conducted." conducting is powerful. You know, that interaction, you know, composing is isolating. Leonard Bernstein was a person of the people. He'd come into rehearsals and he would hug the musicians, physically hug the musicians. He loved them. This gave him energy and allowed him to survive. So I don't know, really, what would have happened if he had just devoted himself to composing.
I'm actually very glad that he did as much conducting as he did, and also the teaching, because if you were going to ask me about he was also a pianist, he was a lot of different things, but if you were going to have me rank his genius, it would be somewhere between conducting and teaching at the top, with composing well down the list. Now, that's not to say that there weren't some masterpieces, but they tended to be things like Candide and West Side Story, and for me at least, a lot of this so-called very serious Bernstein work really doesn't hold up all that well. I don't like the Mass very much. I don't like most of the symphonies. It seemed to me he was best when he was turning out this fabulous show music, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I mentioned Rossini earlier, who's one of the very great composers, and something went away from him, at least a lot of us think, when he was writing serious music. I mean tragedies as opposed to his marvelous comedies. You know, it's just a genius in a different way. It's sad though, because Bernstein didn't see this. I had a friend who was with him sometime late in life, and Bernstein was bemoaning the fact that he'd be remembered for West Side Story, And the person who was with him sort of said to privately, well, it's better than being remembered for A Quiet Place, which was his last opera, and basically considered a disaster.
You could do an awful lot worse. Clive Gillison, I just want to ask you about this, the American-ness of Leonard Bernstein. I mean, if you think back to that time, it wasn't an easy time. You're talking the early 70s when he was conducting you in the London Symphony. Nevertheless, he brought all of his history with him. He brought a certain American idea or atmosphere with him. Can you remember the America that Leonard Bernstein represented to you as a musician in London in those days? Is it still there? Is it still there in New York?
I think in a way America has changed enormously, so has the world. But I must say, I do agree with everything that Tim and Barbara said. I mean, I think all of Lenny's talents were complementary, and you know, he was an extraordinary talent in all these ways, and I can't imagine him not wanting to explore those. I remember somebody talking about him once and saying, in relation to this question, it would be a bit like somebody having said to Shakespeare, why don't you stop writing those stupid sonnets and concentrate on the plays? It would be just the same thing. I mean, Lenny did so many things extraordinarily. I mean, he was, you know, probably the greatest conductor I ever worked with. I mean, I personally think West Side Story is the greatest musical ever written. And what I love as well is the fact that my children feel that as well. It's not a generation thing. It's actually something for all time and for all people. The way he worked with children, the way he worked with education. And interestingly enough, when we created with him and opened the Pacific Music Festival in Sapporo, A Japanese journalist said to him, "Maestro, you've been a great conductor, a great composer, all of these things. If you could only choose one, which would it be?" And he said, "Well, that would be very easy to choose. It would be education, because I was taught by the most extraordinary artists and geniuses in the world, and it is my responsibility to make sure I pass on everything I learned to the next generation." And I think for him, that lay at the center of everything he did.
Let's go to Susan in Stowe, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have an international perspective to share on Bernstein.
Please.
In the mid-80s, I was at Tanglewood to see Bernstein conducting the Tanglewood Festival Orchestra and Chorus, And this was the grand evening of Midori's debut. When I got there, a bus pulled up into the parking lot, and all these Japanese tourists were getting off the bus. They had no idea where they were. They were on a tour of the U.S., and they didn't know what was going on. And one of them said to me, "What is this place?" I said, "It's Tanglewood." And they said, "What do you mean?" And I said one word, "Bernstein." And everybody on the bus started screaming and running. They actually started running out of the bus and headed for the bowl to take seats on the lawn to see Bernstein.
Is that the night? And Midori broke her strings twice that night.
Twice. And the first time she grabbed a violin from the first violinist, and then the second time she just, someone passed a violin up to her, and Bernstein never missed a beat, and she hardly missed one either.
A powerful,
very excited.
A powerful night with Leonard Bernstein. Jack Beatty, there was something that he represented there to the world about this country. I look at New York today with the towers crashing down on Wall Street. I don't know, it's a different time, but something so powerful, something really of the heart of what's been come to be called the American century.
Yes, and I think he spoke to it at Tanglewood. He gave a talk there in 1970 to the students. He called it the principle of hope, and he might have been talking about himself. He said, "It's the artists of the world, the feelers and the thinkers, who will ultimately save us, who can articulate, educate, defy, insert, sing, and shout the big dreams. Only the artist can turn the not yet into reality." All right. How can you do it? Like this. Find out what you do really well, and then do it for all you're worth.
Mm. Tim, do you still feel that strength, energy, hope in the American cultural community and music community today?
To some extent. I mean, Bernstein has left a huge hole. I mean, I remember the day he died, there were people weeping on the streets of New York, and one of the magazines, one of the newspapers had one of those editorial cartoons, and it was a picture of the world with a little sign that said Leonard Bernstein lived here. It was very touching. I mean, sure, music goes on. There's a lot of fascinating things going on now. But he was very special. One of the things, though, that I think has been great about him is that he opened up so many people's ears to other kinds of music, not just traditional Western classical music, but to rock and to jazz, and who knows what he'd be finding in the various strains of music that we hear today. I mean, he was just marvelous at that.
Barbara Hawes, just give us a taste of what New York will offer this fall from the Bernstein life and work.
If I could just say, though, very quickly,
yes,
about the whole role of music and is it still full of hope. I went to Pyongyang with the Philharmonic when we just went to North Korea and
yes.
played the concert there. And as much as we talk about the power of music and we say that, it was an extraordinary experience of witnessing that, of having it just having an entire audience all of a sudden come to the same place as the orchestra, and with the encore being Bernstein's Candide, which is Candide Overture, which is a signature work of the Philharmonic now, and it's played always without a conductor. Mm-hmm. The conductor, Mazel, stepped aside, and the orchestra plays it. It's like a riderless horse. It's what the Philharmonic still does for its lost maestro.
Wow.
And the audience was so touched. So I'd say it was one of those examples of extraordinary power of music, and it really is. Bernstein is still with us.
Well, just try Googling New York and Bernstein and this fall, and you will see a tremendous outpouring. A little bit here from that overture to Candide from the performance in February in Pyongyang, North Korea. Barbara Hawes, author of Leonard Bernstein, an American original. Thank you so much for being with us for the conversation today.
Thank you.
And Clive Gillison, thank you very much for being here.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Tim Page, author of Glenn Gould and Music from the Road, always wonderful to have you. And Jack Beatty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll go out with Leonard Bernstein, Overture to Candide. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.